Welcome to Scavenger's Horde. We're a podcast where we talk about Star Wars and other things. If you're new here, let me introduce myself. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Kirsty.
This is episode 198, and it's 24th of March, 2024. So, as has been our pattern recently, it's been a little while since we last recorded. And that's honestly just because we're both really busy people, and finding the time to do this podcast alongside, you know, our normal lives and our normal commitments is really tricky. And because of that reason, we've actually made a decision to kind of go on an indefinite hiatus after we get to episode 200. So yeah, that's obviously like just the announcement in plain language. Obviously, we're going to talk about it a little bit before we get into the proper episode. But yeah, Kirsty, do you want to share your thoughts on it quickly, just to stop me rambling?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been a long time coming because people have probably noticed that our schedule is all over the place. And it,
yeah.
Oh, it's unfortunate because I feel sad about it because it comes down to a lot of boring, like, practical stuff in terms of, like, obviously we have this normally 8-hour time difference that makes it really hard for us to schedule. And for the first few years we did it, we were actually able to record almost weekly, right? We were,
yeah.
I look back and I'm like, how did we do that?
That's an excellent point. Yes.
But we just had more free time and now we don't, and it bums me out, but it doesn't bum me out too much because, like, our lives are also going pretty well. We're happy. So it's like, there's just too much other stuff going on.
Exactly. And to be completely clear, this, obviously, Kirsty and I are still going to be friends. So Kirsty and I will still talk, but it's just there's a very big difference in terms of the time commitment between, like, Kirsty and I having a chat for 20 minutes, half an hour, and us sitting down for like 3 hours to record a podcast. And then all the associated work that goes into preparing the notes and doing the editing is just a lot of labour. And yeah, so we're still good, we're still going to be chatting, we're still going to be in touch, but yeah, it's just not tenable really to keep doing this podcast indefinitely. And I want to say that I'm really, really proud of this podcast, and honestly I've had an amazing time doing it, so I'm really, really happy that we did this endeavour, basically, and it's given me the most brilliant friendship with you, Kirsty, and I'll always be so grateful for that, you know. It's just like proper friends for life stuff, you know, and you can't put a price on that. And yeah, I'm really glad that I'm going to have that to take with me going forward.
I feel the exact same, and I don't know if people could tell, but like at the beginning of the podcast, we didn't really know each other that well. Like, we've been talking for a little bit, but really it's doing this show that's like built our friendship.
Yeah.
And as you say, like, we're gonna keep talking to each other afterwards. It's not like this is over.
Yeah.
We talk to each other almost every day. We have plans to see each other in person over the summer. So like, that's what we've got out of it to take into the future. And just as you say, I am also really proud of the podcast and what we've done over the years. It's weird to look back and like feel how different things are in terms of like the fandom landscape overall, and how it, I mean, I know there's still like this old Star Wars is for boys thing that's like always going to be an element of the fandom, unfortunately. But I do think that a lot of female and non-binary and I think the fandom has like opened up and felt more representative of what all Star Wars fans are and what they all have to say and what they enjoy, and it's nice to have been like a little part of that.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm not saying that like this podcast changed at all in terms of like the podcasting landscape for, you know, like women and non-binary people in Star Wars fandom, but like Kirsty said, I do feel like we've made a small contribution. We started this podcast in 2016, you know, obviously inspired by The Force Awakens. I just didn't see other people doing what I wanted to hear. You know, I wanted to hear a different type of perspective, a different type of view on this thing that I'd become obsessed with, basically. And I was like, well, if other people aren't going to do it, I'm going to try and put together something myself. And I think you and I met on the Raylo forum, Kirsty. I'm sure we crossed paths in other places as well. But I feel like that's really where we started back and forth. And yeah, then obviously went from there, you know, and decided, hey, let's try doing this podcasting thing together. And here we are almost 200 episodes later. And yeah, it's a body of work, you know, and I'm not saying it's like always exactly as I would want it to be if I were like writing an essay and like perfectly phrasing everything I said. But I do feel like I've made strong points. I feel like I've really shared my genuine feelings about this thing. I feel like I've shared work I've done to research particular like theories and perspectives on media and literature. And yeah, I'm proud as shit of that, you know. And along those lines, my plan is very much to keep this podcast up as like a record. It's currently hosted on what was Anchor and is now Spotify for Podcasters. So who knows what might happen to Spotify for Podcasters in the future. But if anything does happen, I have backups of every episode. And in the worst case scenario, I'd find a way to put it on YouTube or something. Because, yeah, I want it to be there, you know. So I really value like the history of fandom. It's something that very easily gets overlooked and forgotten. And I feel like it's interesting as shit. So
yeah, I really it's like a time capsule now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. If like we went back to those very early podcasts in 2016, which I'm loathe to do because I'm sure the audio quality is horrible. But again, it would be a really, really interesting insight into the discourse that was going on at that specific moment in time and where our own minds were at in relation to all things Star Wars. And yeah, I think that's cool to keep there, basically. So yeah, that's very much my plan.
It's funny to think about kind of looking back and like thinking about the context in which we started, because like, you don't want to generalize too much, like, oh, the men of the fandom think this and the women of the fandom think this, because there were, it was very easy to make these generalizations, and there were a lot of female fans who felt very differently about where the story would go from us, who were like, hey, I don't think that, and that's not cool for you to say that. And they were right, you know, like, it's nuanced, it's individual and specific to how we all relate to the story and what we might want from the story in the future. But there were these generalizations going on that it was hard not to discuss the what was happening within those parameters, right?
Yes.
And it did feel significant to be like, hey, I've always been a Star Wars fan, but like to get to the extent where you felt the need to go online and talk to other people about it, it was like, whoa, I really care about this. I'm invested, and that's worth examining, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, just thinking back to like how we felt when we started the show, it was like a weird defensiveness that we had to state our case and provide lots of justification for why we felt that way, which is just funny to think about now, because one, I'm way less invested, but also it's like the story's told and it speaks for itself, right? For better and worse.
We were right
but
sorry,
we very easily could have been wrong, and that's the interesting thing with the whole Trevorrow and just all of the mayhem. We'll never get probably a full answer to how things went down, because you know a lot of that stuff's going to be private and subject to NDAs and stuff like that, but god, I'd love a better look at the behind the scenes of all that and what JJ really felt about Ryan and vice versa and stuff, you know.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a tell-all documentary in 20 years. Yeah, and then we'll break I don't know, our hiatus it's Disney, to come though. Back and talk about it.
I'd be surprised if that was authorized by Disney, because they like to keep things under lock and key.
This is true. It'd be like
we didn't
of those...
even get Ryan's coffee table book.
I did see something. There was like an Amazon listing, I think, for that coffee table book, indicating it might be coming out next year.
Really?
I've got no idea if that's like a cruel joke, but there
I don't
was
know
a sign
if he has
life.
The rights to that stuff, though.
I know. But I like to remain optimistic. I think a pattern of this podcast is that I'm generally more optimistic than you.
Sorry.
No, don't apologise. It's funny. It's part of the dynamic. But yeah, I'm going to hold on to hope on that front. I'm not holding out hope for the Rian Johnson trilogy. I think that ship has long since sailed.
Unfortunately.
I will keep the humble hope for the coffee table book. Maybe even like a little insight into Fireman's Carry. Who knows? But yeah, that's a Raylo reference, guys, in case you don't get it.
My Roman Empire.
Yeah, exactly, my Roman Empire. But yeah, no, like, and obviously I do phrase it as we're going to go on indefinite hiatus after episode 200, because we don't want to definitively say we are never going to podcast again after that point, just because, you know, that's the recipe for ending up with egg on your face, right? Like, if the Rey movie happens, for example, and we watch it and we're like, holy shit, we have things to say, we're not ruling out coming back, you know, to have that type of discussion. So yeah, don't unsubscribe from the podcast feed, because who knows what might happen, basically. That's my advice.
Oh, and we should also make sure that we thank all the listeners for being supportive over the years. We really appreciate it.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah. Honestly, like, part of the impetus to keep this podcast going is that miraculously people do still listen to us. as proven by objective statistics on Spotify for podcasters. So yeah, thank you to each and every one of you. Like, we really, really do appreciate it. So I know in particular there must be some people who've been there with us since the beginning, since 2016, and obviously everyone who listens is very welcome and really valued. But if you've been with us since then, wow, what a journey.
That's wild. It's such a long time.
It is wild. But yeah, and on that note, you know, obviously if you do have like a message you want to share, you know, something you'd like us to read out, like, obviously you can reach us on the Scavengers Horde Twitter. You can send us an email at scavengershorde@gmail.com. And yeah, we'll happily try and read out some thoughts if there's anything you want us to commit to WAV format before we wind the podcast down. And yeah, we are hoping to record our thoughts on The Acolyte. So we don't have like a strict plan, so we're not going to commit to dates right now. But yeah, we are both planning to watch The Acolyte, and we'll hopefully try and cover that before we end the podcast. So we've already had like months between episodes, so like waiting until Acolyte is nothing.
Tell you what, those months waits, they can often be so frustrating because... Like I said, the time difference means that we can only really record together at the weekend. And if something happens, like one of us gets sick or like we have something going on, it just means suddenly it's a month later and we're like, oh yeah, we should probably record, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and it is really tricky because, again, if circumstances were different, you know, if we were both in the same time zone, like, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, you know, because it would be so much less of a... burden to have to record while navigating around that time difference. But that's just the reality of it, and it is a real pain in the butt, you know. So yeah, it is a shame, but I think, like we've said, you know, it's I'm really proud of us for having done it for so long, you know, and having just miraculously made that time difference work for years and years, because it's unbelievably we're closer to 10 years of doing this than 5 years, which completely blows my mind, but it's the truth. And yeah, just mind-boggling in a kind of great way.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be coming up on the 10th anniversary of The Force Awakens.
Time flies. I know that's a cliche, but it's a very true cliche. Especially as you get older, it really does accelerate, guys. So yeah, value all those moments. It's yeah, and honestly, thank you, Kirsty, for doing this with me. Like, I've honestly like enjoyed it so much, and I know it's not the last episode, so we'll be doing it again. But yeah, I just really do want to say that, because it's been one of the things I'm proudest of, and I know that might sound a bit sad maybe, but it is true. Like, I really do see this as like a real work of like passion and like a real outlet for my like personal expression and my just enthusiasm for media in general. And yeah, I'm always be proud of it and really happy that we did it, so thank you.
Me too. I want to thank you as well, and I need to give you your flowers, because I don't know if everyone's aware, but Rachel does way more work to make this podcast happen than I do. Like, we need to make that clear and put it out there, because the time that it takes you to research, prepare, coordinate, edit, put it out there when it's all done, like, that is, you know, that's a big deal. And we're approaching 200 episodes. Like, how many hours of work is that?
A lot.
So I really appreciate it.
Thank
and
you.
Everyone should be grateful to Rachel if they've enjoyed this show. So
thank you very much. That's really kind of you to say. Oh my god. Wow. Yeah. No, that was really lovely. You know, like, obviously it's like, it is a sad thing. You know, I feel like a sense of melancholy about it as well, even though I also agree with Kirsty that it's the right time to be doing this. But yeah, it's nice to have such like a lovely kind of like celebratory conversation almost, you know, while sharing what in other circumstances could be news that's a bit of a bummer, you know. So yeah, that was really nice. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so with that emotional segment out of the way, let's get down to business and talk about the main piece of news to have emerged since we last recorded, which is that The Acolyte finally has a publicly available trailer, which is honestly kind of mind-blowing to me that it's taken this long, because I have like a weird perception of this, and there's no way to say this without sounding boastful, so I apologise in advance. But obviously I saw a trailer for The Acolyte at Celebration in London last year in April.
I'd forgotten about that.
I know. And like at the time, I loved it so much. I was so hyped and so psyched about it. And I was like, oh my God, this looks like my everything. I just loved it. And I don't know. I just feel weird about this trailer. So I feel like, obviously I can't see that trailer from Celebration again, so it's not available anywhere. But I feel like this publicly available one is very similar. So there's not much new material as such in this trailer. And it certainly doesn't give you any more insight into the story than the Celebration one did. So I've got to be honest right out of the gate that this trailer felt a bit of an anticlimax for me. Especially, you know, coming from the privileged position where I'd already seen a lot of the footage before. But yeah, like there's really cool stuff, you know, like the characters look intriguing. Love Carrie Anne Moss. You know, there's interesting hints as to what the themes might be, but I don't know, it just felt like it was missing something intangible, you know, that I can't quite pin down, and that's a bit of a bummer to me. But yeah, Kirsty, what do you think?
Well, I haven't seen that first trailer, but I'm kind of with you in that it definitely feels like they're holding something back, which, you know, I get, like, a trailer is not supposed to tell you the whole story, and I actually get annoyed when like I watch a movie trailer and I do feel like I saw the whole story. So, you know, you're not satisfied either way, but again, a trailer is not meant to satisfy, so we already know we're going to watch the show. So I guess it's not really for us. I guess I'd be curious. Actually, I do have someone. My husband watched the trailer before me, and he was like, is that Carrie Anne Moss? And I think he's going to watch the show with me, and he has not watched a lot of the Star Wars TV series.
So it actually got him quite hyped for it then.
Yeah, and it's mainly because of her and how badass she is.
Yeah, which is a good reason.
Yeah, but obviously the story or what they presented did not put him off. He was like, okay, cool, it's like prequel era. And with Phantom Menace being back in theatres and everything, like, I think people would be kind of in the spirit for something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess I'll talk to a few more people who... it's hard to get away from that term casual fan, but it just means that they're normal people who aren't insane like us.
Yeah, people who don't podcast about Star Wars, basically.
Yeah. I'd be curious to see what people think and if this has, like, intrigued them enough to check it out.
Yeah, no.
It's very different from, like, The Mandalorian, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I feel like The Mandalorian is sort of, like, prime casual material, because I know so many people who watch The Mandalorian almost exclusively because of the Baby Yoda hype. You know, they're like, oh, he's so cute. I want to see the story with that creature. Like, I literally know people who have said that as being, like, their main reason for watching the show, which is a perfectly valid reason. I can't really understand it, but it's still a perfectly valid reason. Whereas I feel like this one, it is more... It feels like it's more targeted at people who love Jedi. Well, it obviously is, because obviously The Mandalorian, that is not the focus. I know they go into the whole like Luke thing, and then they have Ahsoka in The Mandalorian, but you know, it's very much a different slice of Star Wars that The Mandalorian is based around. Whereas The Acolyte, it's really like the Jedi in their full powers. You know, you get a shit ton of Jedi, a shit ton of lightsabers, lots of Force users, and I think fundamentally that's a really exciting concept. I feel like at its core, it might hold the most inherent appeal for like existing Star Wars fans who love the Jedi and are intrigued and want to see lightsaber battles. So yeah, I feel like what was missing for me from this trailer was selling you on the non-Star Wars hook of it all, you know, in terms of what's the character journey, what's the emotional hook, you know, who we follow in the story. So I get the sense that it's Amandla Stenberg's character, May. But, you know, it really is very much flitting from character to character, so it doesn't give, like, a good grounding of that. And I don't necessarily think that's a mistake for a first trailer, because a first trailer is just about building up the intrigue and making people aware that this thing is coming. But I think for me, it just shows that we need to get that from a subsequent trailer in terms of, like, okay, this is what the story is.
Yeah, it'd be great to have a trailer that focuses on some of those key characters and, like, yeah, how they fit into this world that's, like, what is it, 100 years before Phantom Menace? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I feel like that's the date that's been flung around typically. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, a lot of people, even if they didn't love the prequels, they'd be intrigued by, like, well, how did the Jedi get to that state in the first place, you know? So this kind of, it shows a bit of chaos, these Jedi and becoming former Jedi, and, like, you know, what makes someone at this stage walk away from being a Jedi, or were they pushed out or something, you know, what happened? So, you know, there are some questions.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, like, I feel like this is, like, ripe for storytelling, and, like, everything that Leslie Headland has been saying about this show sounds like exactly our jam, you know, in terms of there's lots of focus on the moral ambiguity, there's, like, an emphasis on, you know, what if the Darksiders were, like, the underdogs, you know, what if they were the ones without the power, because that's very much what we're used to in Star Wars storytelling, that, you know, there's the heroes on the light side and they're, like, the scrappy underdogs, whereas in this, the scrappy underdogs are the Darksiders, the people, like, looking at that side of the Force. And I do think that's a really fascinating angle to go for, especially in terms of offering something that feels fresh and new, which is a real challenge in Star Wars, where it feels like we've got so many iterations of similar themes and it can start to feel a bit repetitive. So yeah, I think if Leslie Headland delivers, and it really does feel like this, like, fresh, invigorating take on Star Wars, has the potential to be really exciting.
You've been more enmeshed with the High Republic stuff than I have. I feel like I haven't read any of those books for a long time now. Do you feel like anything kind of stands out to you?
Yeah. That world? There's one character in the trailer, Vanestra Rowe, who I think is played by Rebecca Henderson, who's Leslie's wife. And yeah, she's from the High Republic books, is a, tween, I guess, is the sort of age she's at when she's introduced in those books. And I think the idea is that she's from a very long-lived species, so she's very old at the time she appears in The Acolyte. But, you know, that's just because of this extended lifespan. But I've seen an interview of Leslie where she says that none of the other characters from the High Republic books appear in that first season. And I guess that's not ruling out people being mentioned, you know, and there being references to the world building in those books. So I think there would have to be some of that. But yeah, I feel like they're probably going to keep the actual overt references pretty minimal. So they probably wouldn't want to alienate people who haven't read those books, because that's always a recipe for disaster, right?
Yeah, but that, I feel like that does sometimes happen, where they plug things in that are just not going to be geared towards a general audience.
Yeah. I do feel like the inclusion of Vanessa is very much like a fan-pleasing, like, move, like, and which is completely valid and makes sense. You know, I think they revealed that Vanessa was going to be in The Acolyte at the High Republic panel that they had at London last year, which is the perfect crowd to reveal that information to, right? Because that's people who know that character, have read the books, and have that involvement. I think I've read one of the young adult or children's books, potentially, that had Vanessa in it. To be honest, I don't remember much about the character. It was years ago that I read that book. I'm sure it'd be cool to see her, but yeah, it won't have that, like, huge emotional significance to me. I've read more of Phase 1 than I have of Phase 2 with the High Republic. And in Phase 2, they did a thing where Phase 2 is a prequel to Phase 1. So I can't... it's so confusing. I can't remember how many years before Phase 1, Phase 2 is. But that sort of, like, knocked a lot of the wind out of the sails of it for me, because You know, they really set up a cliffhanger in phase one, you know, and sometimes they're like, oh, what's going to happen to the Jedi now that the Nihil are rising, etc., etc. And then it just completely abandoned all of that to tell a completely different story. So I don't really get the thinking behind that move, but it's like someone must have thought it was a good idea. It's like, fine, not my personal preference of storytelling, but whatever.
You're right, though, because I might have carried on reading it if it was about what would happen with the Nihil and stuff, and the wind kind of came out of the sails for me.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they've gone back to that now in phase three. They've like returned to the whole Martian
Emperor storyline. Yeah, but they lost me.
Yeah, no, like, honestly, I haven't read any of the phase three books yet. And partially that was because by the end of phase one, I was like, Marcia Monroe has been like hyped up as this like epically like cool different type of villain with like all these like interesting layers, you know, and there are all these like, there's all this hype around him. He's just like a boring pirate man. I'm sorry, I probably like offended people, but I just did not love that character. And the Jedi themselves, there's just so many of them that I was just like losing track. So again, I feel like that underlines something that I really want from the Acolyte. I really want a strong point of view, because obviously there's a lot of characters, which is fine, but I want there to be like a unified story and a personal story, because from the High Republic books, that was often what was missing for me, because the characters did have their own arcs and their own personal journeys. But when you have like 10 different point of view characters, how much attention can you realistically give each of their development, right? So yeah, I really want that like personal focus in this.
Yeah, same. I'm sure we'll get it. I have faith in Leslie.
Yeah, no, same. She's saying all the right things in interviews, you know, and honestly, the interviews that she's given have made me more excited than the trailer itself. Which probably bodes well, you know, because the thing is, Leslie Headland is not going to be the one out there cutting the trailers, you know, so as a creator, you're getting a much clearer insight into her vision and her thinking behind this show when you read her interviews versus when you watch a trailer, which will have been put together by a marketing team to get the most eyeballs on it. So yeah, I recommend people to read her interviews. She gave very good ones to StarWars.com and The Hollywood Reporter, which are out there. And yeah, just in terms of the cast, I really like Daphne Keane. Obviously she was in Logan, and she was also in His Dark Materials, which isn't a perfect adaptation, but I do think she's quite good as Lyra. I like seeing Jodie Turner-Smith as Mother Anaseia. She's the leader of a coven of witches, according to the databank, apparently, which just as a concept I love. So I approve of that. And then we have sequel trilogy veteran Eunice Suetano, who is back as a non-Chewie character. He's playing a Wookiee who lives a solitary life. So hopefully he becomes less solitary over the course of the show. That's what I want for him. And yeah, then Carrie-Anne Moss, who obviously looks really badass. I kind of hope that she's in it for the whole thing. But yeah, we'll see. She's just such a big name. I'm just not sure they could keep her around for the whole show. But then she was in something like Jessica Jones for the whole time. So yeah, if she can do that, she can do the Acolyte for the whole season. We'll find out.
Yeah, people do die in Star Wars, though. So
they do.
Especially all the mentor figures.
Yes. I'm sure several of the people in the cast list I'm looking at right now will die, which is sad, but part of the fabric of Star Wars storytelling. So yeah. okay, cool. So yeah, then the next thing I'd like to talk about is that we have a confirmed date for Star Wars Celebration 2025 tickets going on sale. And they will go on sale on Thursday, the 2nd of May, which is good. So it's plenty of notice so people can make all their like travel arrangements, etc. And without losing their minds. Can you imagine if they'd made the announcement and it was like, you can book tickets from tomorrow?
That would not be fair.
That would be like the maddest of mad scrambles. It would be really bad. But yeah, they're going to go on sale at 4 p.m. Pacific time and 8 a.m. Japanese time. And that is also, coincidentally, not that they cared to announce this, but it's 11 p.m. UK time, which is mildly inconvenient, but not impossible for those in the UK, especially the people mad enough to be going to a Star Wars convention in Japan. And to be clear, I consider myself among that mindset, even though my own sad news is that it's looking very unlikely that I will go to Japan for this convention, which is a bummer. Like, part of me would love to go. I love Japan. I've only been there once before and I loved it. It's an amazing country. And obviously I had the best time at Stars Celebration last year in London, but it is just such a long way and it's such a huge expense involved with attending, you know, with the hotels and the flights, that I'm not sure I can justify it right now. Unless I miraculously win the lottery, I think it's off the cards for me, which is sad, but you have to be a grown up about these things sometimes.
That's where I'm at too. If I had lots more money, maybe yeah. I would go.
Exactly.
I'm sure it's going to be so much fun for people.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like Japan on a shoestring where I was constantly stressing about money at every stage, it just wouldn't be very fun. Like, convention aside, so obviously I wouldn't be going to Japan just to go to the convention. I'd also be going to see Japan. And yeah, like, I want to save that money for when I can go back and really enjoy it. So yeah. Like, that's the plan, but I'm sure it's going to be absolutely incredible for the people who can go, and I am super jealous of my friends who will be going. So I've already seen lots of chatter on Twitter about people who are already making their plans, and I'd love to stow away in your suitcase, but I'd probably have to get to like America or Canada first to get into that suitcase, so it's not going to happen, is it?
You know what, we can just follow along on social media.
This
people are very
true.
Good at like giving you updates, and you can kind of live through their experiences.
Exactly. I feel like the only issue is going to be the time difference, because I feel like when everything happens in Japan, it's going to be a godly unsociable hour in the UK. But that's fine. I can see all the news when I wake up, so I'll be fine.
Do you think there's a chance that Daisy will show up?
I feel like if... Like, God, that bloody Ray movie. Like, it's been such a roller coaster. There's all sorts of, like, rumour and...
I've heard about this stuff, like, secondhand, but is there, like, a delay on when it might come out now? Or is it just... I don't know, what's happening?
I feel like there's just a lot of uncertainty. Like, when Daisy was promoting her new movie, she was basically saying that she still hasn't got a script, that she's about to get a script. Yeah, exactly. Oh. So I think people are very... cold feet about it, in the sense that we're not going to believe this thing is real until they've announced that they've started shooting, basically, which I think is sensible at this stage. I was so excited for that project when it was announced, and I really, really do want it to happen. So I think it's a very wise move to continue Ray's story while Daisy's still young, you know, and can still be more of like a central figure in the narrative. But yeah, at the same time, I don't want to like clown myself like we all did over the Ryan Johnson films.
Oh, it's not you clowning yourself, though. It's Lucas so I'm clowning us all.
Yeah.
If it turns out that they brought Daisy out for that announcement and then that movie doesn't happen, that's incredibly embarrassing.
Yeah, it would be so, so deeply embarrassing and just awful for them to do to their actor as well, to do to Daisy. Mm. Like, if I were her and they put me in that position, I'd be like, give me like $50 million or I'm never going to do Star Wars again. After you put me through that shit. And yeah, there's just weird stuff going on. Like, they've just announced a Peaky Blinders movie that Stephen Knight is writing. And obviously Stephen Knight...
Oh yeah, I saw that, but I didn't connect the dots.
Yeah, exactly. Stephen Knight's obviously the guy who's meant to be writing the Ray movie. And who's to say that he can't do two things at once? But it does feel like that project is the one that's moving along and actually has momentum.
It's Killian's era now, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. It makes sense that they'd move that along. So yeah, we will see. I'm sure there'll be an update of some description, whether positive or negative, before too long. But yeah, I feel like if it has started filming before Star Wars Celebration Japan happens, I feel like Daisy will go there, you know, just to be like, hey guys, we're so excited. And, you know, they might show like the tiniest of sizzle reels, the tiniest, you know, just to show, look, there's proof, we actually have some footage that we filmed, you know, that sort of thing. But I feel like if it's still like they don't have their act together by the time that convention takes place, I can't imagine Daisy would go, because yeah, otherwise they would just be doubly clowning themselves, right?
So. I mean, talking of clowning, it could go the other way and they could even bring out like John Boyega or someone.
God, yeah. I'll feel so much FOMO if that something happens. I'll be like, oh, fuck. You should have just sucked up the cost and gone. But yeah, no, it is fine. I can't think like that. I hope for the sake of the people who go that they do get an amazing, really cool reveal or announcement like that. Because, yeah, just being in the room when they announce something like that is just so electric. And you just can't replicate that feeling easily. You know, like when Daisy came out, I was there with like Wes. And... yeah, just the best feeling. It was incredible. It's like, yeah, just an amazing fandom high. So yeah, I'm sure it would be an incredible convention. And yeah, I'm very jealous of everyone who's going. But I think it's great. So I know it's been a long time since they did it in Japan. And obviously, the main rationale is for Japanese people to get a chance to attend, right? Because it's not realistic to expect people from Japan to travel to America or the UK or wherever they hold it, you know?
Yeah, it's probably easier for people to come from Australia and stuff like that as well. So.
Yeah, exactly. So it opens up opportunities for like a whole different cohort of fans who might not normally get the chance. And yeah, it's great for them. Okay, anything else to add on Celebration, Kirsty, or should we move on?
Don't think so, yeah.
Okay, sweet. And yeah, then the final thing I wanted to talk about is that Star Wars The Phantom Menace is back in theatres, and they're also doing a full marathon of the 9 Skywalker Saga films back in cinemas, which maybe it means I'm getting old, but to me that just sounds exhausting. And I'm just like, look, I love these films, mostly. I'd love to sit down and watch them, but I don't want to see all 9 in a row. What's
so
wrong
do
you
have
you?
To see all 9?
I think so. I think the way it's set up is it will literally just be one after the other, which I think is bloody dumb, to be honest. I think they should do it like one film a day, because then I'd happily go and rewatch the sequel trilogy. Controversial, I'd even go back and rewatch Trost.
I'd love to see the originals.
Yeah.
I've not seen them in theatres.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, that would be so amazing. Yeah, because for me, that's less of an urgent thing, because I have seen them in theatres.
But you haven't seen the prequels, right? Or at least.
No, I haven't.
Not Phantom Menace.
But I do now have the ticket booked to see The Phantom Menace, which is very exciting. So, unless I just completely cannot remember my childhood. To the best of my knowledge, I've not seen The Phantom Menace in cinemas before.
I saw all the prequels, but I mean, even The Last Jedi, I'd love to see that in theatres again. But yeah. if they're going to make you buy a ticket for all of them, then that's exactly. Not happening. I don't have that much time.
No, exactly. It's, yeah. Like, I feel like it would be fun to maybe just like drop in for like TFA and Last Jedi double bill and then sneak out, but yeah.
I don't have tickets for The Phantom Menace yet, but I have a ticket for The Matrix because it's also the 25th anniversary of that.
Oh, amazing. Is that also on the 4th of May?
No, it's... my ticket, I think it's for the first week of April.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly. But yeah, I just saw that they're showing it at the cinema near me.
Oh, that's so exciting.
And The Phantom Menace, I think they're showing for like over a week, so yeah. I'll definitely get in at some point.
Yeah, no, I was really happy. Initially, I thought they might just be showing The Phantom Menace on May the 4th itself. But then I realised they're showing it for several days after, which is great. So I had plans to do something non-Star Wars-y on May the 4th. And I was like, oh, God. Like, what if I can't do this? But then I was like, okay, they're doing loads of showings on the 5th of May too. So I'll be fashionably late and watch it then instead. So, yeah, that's my plan. So initially, I did book a ticket for May the 4th, but then the screening ended at like 11:30 p.m. or something. And it's like, I can't do that. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's dedication.
Yeah.
And they said that there's going to be an exclusive look at the Acolyte. Do you think that's like a behind the scenes kind of thing?
Yeah, like I'm really excited for that. I reckon it's probably going to be like a featurette type thing. Like I doubt they would launch a new trailer that way, but I feel like a featurette in its own right could be really interesting. Part of me would love to see like a scene or a new trailer or something, but I feel like they'll probably wait until like mid-May or something to do that, but who knows, we'll find out soon enough. But yeah, whatever the case, like as I said earlier about the Acolyte, I'm really excited to see more and get a stronger sense of the story. So hopefully that's really where they start doing that in earnest. So I feel like it's a brilliant move to combine that with the re-release of The Phantom Menace, because they can really drive home the like how the Acolyte connects to the saga in terms of like orienting it in time in relation to The Phantom Menace. So yeah,
that makes sense.
I think it's gonna be good. So yeah, no, very excited about that. And yeah, I guess there's not really much else to say about that news, to be honest. It's just, yeah, it's happening, and I'm excited to see it in the cinema for the first time. And when we next record, because I imagine we'll probably next record to coincide with the premiere of The Acolyte, I'll also be able to share my feelings about seeing The Phantom Menace in the cinema. So stay tuned, because that's going to be an extremely exciting reveal.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what kind of crowd it draws.
Yeah.
You know, like the ages of people, whether it's people who've already seen it in cinemas or like people taking their kids and just the overall atmosphere, because, you know, those movies have fans, but obviously they still have their fair share of haters at this point too. So
of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's going to be a great experience. I imagine there'll be a great buzz at the screenings. And yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it, to see how like the cycle of these things evolves. Because obviously when The Phantom Menace came out, it was such a crushing disappointment for so many people who'd built up this idea of what Star Wars was in their heads, you know, based on the original trilogy. And then when The Phantom Menace came out and it was what it was, and it was completely contrary to this, like, imaginary Star Wars people had in their minds, it was, like, ugly. You know, there was an ugly reaction to that film amongst a lot of people. But I feel like the primary audience for this re-release is the people who were kids when it initially came out. And for them, they don't have any of that baggage. You know, they just have this, like, pure love and enthusiasm for it. Because, yeah, it's just associated as this, like, cool thing from their childhood. And yeah, I feel like it will be a very different atmosphere at the end of the Phantom Menace screenings, which would be nice.
I think there's also a growing middle ground, or at least that's where I'm at, that like you can see that the films are flawed, but you know what? The originals are flawed too. And like there are still interesting ideas. It was groundbreaking in lots of different ways. You know, like I don't know. Sometimes there's like a healthy middle ground where you can just kind of appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, I don't think The Phantom Menace is like an amazing movie, like, but I do enjoy it and I appreciate it as a key part of the Star Wars storytelling. So yeah, like, I am really like keen to see it, but yeah, I won't be one of those people who goes in with like truckloads of childhood nostalgia for The Phantom Menace. But it will be interesting to see how it changes my perception of it. So I have had that experience before where I've seen a movie in the cinema for the first time that I'd only previously seen at home, and it sort of just like radically changes my opinion of it in a good way. And yeah, like, I think I had that with Blade Runner. So like, Blade Runner is a movie I really enjoyed when I watched it at home, but then I saw it in the cinema and I was like, holy shit, this is amazing, you know. And I'm not saying that will necessarily happen with The Phantom Menace, but who knows, don't count it out. So yeah, it's all good times. Okay, I'm just trying to think if there's anything else I need to report before we move on. I don't necessarily think there is. Okay, so let's go on to our non-Star Wars segment, which is what we've been watching / reading. So we're going to start off with a discussion of Dune Part 2. I would find it very difficult to talk about this film without spoiling the shit out of it. So I'd imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast have already watched Dune or read the book, etc. So I'd like to give Kirsty and I permission to talk about it with spoilers. Do you want to go into book spoilers, Kirsty, or is that too mean? Should we?
I think we could, like, vaguely in terms of speculating about what it means for Messiah.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. Yeah, well, we won't, like, be like, and this is how Dune Messiah ends. We won't do that.
To be honest, I've read or listened to Dune and Messiah, but they kind of just washed over me.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on, there's so many different characters, there's so much discussion of the politics and the war and everything that I'm, you know, like, I come away with, like, a sense of certain things and, like, the characters' relationships and that, but in terms of specifics, a lot of it I just struggle to remember.
Yeah, that's very fair.
But that makes the movies enjoyable.
They're very dense.
Oh, right, yeah.
They are very dense. okay, but yeah, that is your spoiler warning for this discussion about Dune Part 2, basically. We're going to talk about it with spoilers. And yeah, if you don't want to hear spoilers, if you skip ahead by about 10 minutes, that should be safe. And if not, I will edit out the reference to 10 minutes because it will not be accurate. Okay, so yeah, what did you think about Dune Part 2, Kirsty?
I really enjoyed it. I liked the first Dune. I think we talked about it on the show when it came out. And I hadn't had time to revisit before Part 2 came out, but it was on my mind. And I didn't have a ton of expectation, to be honest. Like, I have faith in this director that he will make quality movies. Like, nothing that he's made has felt bad to me.
Yeah.
So I went in just like, yeah, I think this is going to be good. But, like, it surpassed, like, anything. I was surprised by how much I liked it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No. How about you?
I really liked it, with some reservations. Basically, so I thought it looked absolutely majestic. It was beautiful, you know, in terms of the cinematography and how it was filmed. And it's a movie where I really enjoyed the ideas and the themes it was exploring more than I latched on to the character journeys and the emotional stuff, if that makes sense. And I feel like that's where it falls down for me, I guess, to some extent. But it doesn't even fair to say fell like down. Yeah, no, exactly. And I've tried to start reading The First Dune, and I've had that exact problem, right? You know, because it is not a book that is written for you to be like, wow, this poor guy's fascinating. I really want to, like, understand his mind and just get into his psyche. That is not the point. He's very much like a figurehead. He's like a symbol of various things that Frank Herbert wants to explore, which is all fine, but it's not personally what I respond to most deeply in fiction. And yeah, so, like, I really liked the stuff exploring how religion was used to manipulate the Fremen. For example, I found that fascinating. You know, it's so insidious, all the colonial aspects of the story, where you have Paul and Lady Jessica come in, and they're basically gradually encroaching on these people's culture until they come to dominate the culture and become like the figureheads of it, you know, in the political and the religious senses. You know, and I thought that development was shown really, really well, and, like, was really fascinating. And that was probably the part of the movie I found the most interesting, I think, in this one.
Yeah, there was an interesting exploration of intent as well, because throughout you've got Paul actually being in conflict with his mom and, you know, saying, I am not here to lead you, I'm here to work with you.
Yeah.
Like, to the Fremen. And then that just goes all out the window.
Yeah, exactly. And then he becomes like baby dictator, kind of, when he's given like his big rally speech. It's like, oh boy. Yeah, and I feel like that's almost like the point at which the film lost me a little bit, because it felt very rapid in terms of that turn for Paul. And I do understand why that turn happens, you know, and why it has to happen for the story. But I felt like the first two thirds all felt quite like leisurely and like carefully paced. And then the last third was just like massively accelerated, especially in terms of, you know, the Emperor and his decision to go to Arrakis. That felt so incredibly abrupt to me. I was like, what the fuck, man? This feels like a really stupid decision at that point. But yeah, like, that was just my perception. And I know that, like, most people, like, really thought it was a masterpiece. So I know I'm in the minority for that.
Yeah, I was just really impressed what it was able to do, as you say, visually. I think it looks amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm with you on not being able to empathise with some of the characters, but compared to the book, I actually find myself really drawn to Chani and Zendaya's performance in a way that surprised me, because the book, you know, she's a character where Frank Herbert really falls down.
Yes.
And I'm really interested to see what they're going to do with that character going forward, like the choices that Denis made here. And obviously working with the actress on her portrayal, like, there's something there that is not super evident in the book that made me connect with her more.
Yeah. So have you seen the David Lynch Dune?
I have, but a long time ago. I plan to rewatch it soon.
Yeah.
But I don't have a strong memory. I mean, I remember Sting in his underwear.
Yes, which is a very iconic thing to remember. But, like, have not finished the book. I've started reading the book, but I've not finished it. But my impression is that the depiction of Chani as, like, a more passive love interest type character, like that is more what you get in the Lynch Dune, you know, which is kind of, like, more in line with the book. Whereas Villeneuve, like, I feel like he completely reinvented it. For the film, which I think is a very, very positive change, because that character is just a whole lot of nothing in the Lynch film, and I imagine it's probably similar in the book. And
she's not nothing, because I think Paul and Chani's relationship is pretty interesting, and obviously the dynamic with Irulan gets, like, intense. But in terms of, like, relating to a character, you know, you don't go into Dune really, like, it's not what you go to Dune for. So it surprised me that she resonated with me so much in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, they've just put way more meat on that character.
Yeah. And I really feel like her emotional journey was definitely the strongest in the film, in terms of, you see her going from this, like, tentative trust in Paul, and then this romance blossoms between them. And then you just see like the dawning realization on her as she registers what's happening. And yeah, just this like profound sense of betrayal that she feels, just in so many, on so many levels. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, part of me, like the cynic, I guess, wonders if they made that choice because they really, really wanted to make it super obvious that Paul's being the bad guy.
Mm.
Like you needed to see him from Shani's eyes there with the scales fall, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, if that's the case, then that's a bit condescending.
Yeah.
But I thought the execution was good. So it's like, whatever. But it just, yeah, I'm now curious to see where they're going to go because it's quite a bold change to make given... I just can't quite see how it's all going to fit together. I know there's like a time jump of 12 years and I wonder if that will still be the case with the next film because then you'll obviously miss the bulk of the actual war. You just kind of have Paul reflecting on it and the implications and then you pick up with, well, you know, them starting their family and stuff. So yeah. It's like, are you going to see that reunion? Because it'd be weird if you didn't.
Exactly. Right? It's kind of like, how can you tell that story without showing how they actually come together? Because they're so far apart at the end of June Part 2, right? You know, and it's like, if you were to then start June Messiah, the film adaptation, with, yeah, like, oh yeah, that was all forgotten, and like, Chani's like his concubine now, and it's all cool, and they're together. You know, that would be like the most massive, like, tonal whiplash. In terms of feeling like, well, that was kind of pointless then, showing that sense of betrayal and her rejection of him. So yeah, they have to tell that story, you know, is like, what does he do to like earn her trust back, you know, and show her that they should be together. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing, because it's like, they're gonna veer off so wildly that, because Paul from the books would not do anything to justify Charlie going back to him, like, if she's made that choice. Because he tells his mom, like, she'll come around. But what would he do except renounce the path that he's on and would be on throughout the Messiah? So,
yeah.
I can't quite see how it's going to work, but I'll be interested. It's just like, Charlie would be the one to change then.
Exactly. You know? And it was interesting how they sort of like reframed his relationship with Irulan as well, because again, my knowledge of the book is that like in the original, it's very heavily caveated that he's purely marrying Irulan for political purposes. And obviously it's obviously a political thing in the film too, right? But you know, there's this whole speech about how I'll never touch her, you know, she'll never be my real wife, she'll never have my children like you will, Chani, that sort of thing. And yeah, I got different vibes from the film, you know. I'm not saying
I got different vibes from Irulan, but that's just Florence Pugh being her sexy self.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, and I feel like that makes it more interesting, because I feel like in the books it's very much like, yeah, I don't have the slightest bit of interest in you, and that basically eliminates any tension there. And I'm not saying they need to do like a full-blown love triangle, but I don't know, it just feels like there's more interesting ways to handle that dynamic than there was in the book potentially. But yeah. I'm sure Denny will do something interesting. I think it's pretty clear that he wants to do his version of Messiah. But I think it's also clear that his version of Messiah will, of necessity, have to veer quite a lot from the book. But at the same time, you can only veer so much and have it still be June Messiah, right? So who knows?
Yeah, obviously it'll anger some purists. Because I remember when I read Messiah, and then I think I mentioned it on the show, I was like, imagine if, like, at the end of the prequels, Padme had stayed with Anakin.
Yeah.
But that's not what Chani's doing, you know? So... yeah, I'm just really curious to see what he does there.
Same. So yeah, like, I think even though I have some reservations, I think it leaves the story in a really, really interesting place. And I'm very excited to see where they go with it. Oh, and also I was disappointed that Alia remained in the womb. I like seeing like murder baby Alia like out as a present entity in the story. But it was cool to see like the fully sentient fetus. That in itself was a very trippy image, which I appreciated. So
yeah. You need to have some element of weirdness in there. If I have one criticism of the film, it's that it doesn't get weird enough, but maybe he'll go all in with the next one.
Yeah, that's true. You know? Like, it felt like almost like kind of sedate sometimes. And I feel like, I think I might have said this on Twitter, but I'm kind of like over sand planets. There's just so many of them in like Star Wars already. And then you get Dune and it's literally a whole movie on a sand planet. And I know that's like the most superficial reason to have a problem with a movie. It's like, oh, I don't like sand. It's rough and irritating. But yeah, I feel like visually, even though it looked beautiful and stunning and majestic, it does mean that, you know, there's certain limits to the variety of the sort of like scenes you can do, you know, in terms of visuals and how varied it can be. And I feel like, I don't know, I like space operas where there's like different colours and different palettes and that sort of thing. But yeah, that's a really shitty reason to criticise it, so don't take that one too seriously.
I would expect more, like, in terms of costume and that, probably some more regal stuff in the next one.
Yes.
With Irulan playing a more centre role. But I also really liked all the Harkonnen stuff, especially Austin Butler was amazing.
Oh, he was really good. And I loved that scene with him and Lea Seydoux. That was fantastic.
I'm sure you did. That was the weirdest it got, I guess.
Yeah. Although, honestly, like, Austin Butler is a very attractive man. And I have seen people, like, thirsting over him, like, with his Dune look. But I can't, guys. I'm sorry. That's, like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's sort of like a line I cannot cross. It's just,
Baldo
like...
Baldo Ren.
That, don't remind me. That, like, level of extreme boldness is just so incredibly unattractive to me. I'm sorry.
Well, it's not even just that. It's
also the whole personality. It's not just the bold thing. Obviously, you're not meant to be like drooling over him, I guess. But at the same time, I don't want to please anyone's attractions, you know, like coming from the former Kylo Ren apologists when that was considered like one of the greatest fandom sins. I'm not going to say anyone's like a dodgy person.
The dynamic with him and Lady Margot, and then even with Paul, with like the notion of, oh, Paul was meant to be a girl and he would have married into the Harkonnens, you know, like, yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, part of me would have liked to have seen Fade introduced earlier, so he was such a good foil.
I know, it's a shame he's gone.
Exactly, it's a pity. It's a pity, but all good things must come to an end. Oh boy. But yeah, I think that's all I want to say on Dune. Anything to add, or you
could? No, I don't think so. Just that if people haven't seen it yet, they should.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it, even with my reservations. It's obviously really spectacular science fiction, and there's few making them better than Denis does nowadays. So yeah, go and see it.
Oh, and I haven't really mentioned Rebecca Ferguson explicitly,
yeah.
But I thought she was really strong in the first film, and she's great in this one too.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
I think she deserves more attention for that role.
Yeah, no, she brings a lot to it. It's again like those sorts of parts, like a mother part, you know, where she's very much there in relation to Paul, you know, but she really...
Well, yeah, but she's also Bene Gesserit, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, no, for sure. And they do it in such an interesting way, you know, where she loves her son, but she's also trying to manipulate him kind of and stuff. And there's so much like nuance and complexity to that performance. It's really interesting. And just the scenes of her like pacing and talking to her unborn child and stuff. That's like...
Creepy.
Yeah, very, very creepy. Like, it wouldn't be out of place in a horror film in a good way. So yeah, no, definitely watch it. So yeah, I think that's us pretty much done for now. So yeah, as I said, if you have any messages to send us about the, you know, the winding down of the podcast, feel free to like message us on Twitter or send us an email at scavengershoard@gmail.com. And yeah, we'll do our best to read out messages people send next time. But yeah, do you have anything else to add before we finish up, Kirsty?
I don't think so. Just that I am looking forward to Acolyte, and I haven't been super... I mean, I say that, but I'll watch the next season of Andor as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's just interesting to be in a place where I'm not automatically watching everything just because it's Star Wars now. It's like they actually do have to kind of convince me that it's going to be worth my time. And I think a lot of fans are probably in that place at this point, right?
Exactly.
So it's kind of entering an interesting era.
Yeah, we're at such like a high saturation point of like high quality media and shows and films and stuff that, yeah, time has to be rationed. It's precious. You need to make carefully informed decisions about what to watch. Okay, so I'm Rachel, and you can find me on Twitter at Rachel1918 and on Tumblr at Star Wars Nonsense.
I'm Kirsty, and you can find both of us on Twitter at Scavengers Horde.
Until next time, bye.
Bye.